back for another coffee session. Today, I would like to start by giving a big thank you to the folks at Fiddler AI because they have sponsored this session. They have decided they were actually one of the first companies to sponsor the community. And so for me, it is something that is truly humbling to see people that are so invested and so interested in the community that they would like to sponsor. They volunteer for sponsoring these initiatives that we're doing, and they want to make sure that the community continues to grow and it continues to be the place for having conversations around MLOps. Today, we're talking with Amit Paca from Fiddler AI, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of things. We've got a lot on the agenda. We're just throwing around some ideas before we hit record. And I know we want to get through some of these ideas around the new EU proposed regulation. We would also like to talk about the way that you can do monitoring with machine learning and not just monitoring for a few metrics after the model is out, but a real in-depth deep dive on monitoring. If you've listened to any other podcast or meetup from us, you probably know that monitoring is one of my favorite subjects. And so today we get to dive into it real deep. And as usual these days, I'm also joined by Vishnu. So welcome to the both of you. It's great to be here. And again, Amit, just before we start, thank you to Fiddler for sponsoring this and sponsoring the community. It's really awesome to see. And yeah, it's heartwarming. You guys are awesome.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Dimitri. I think it's been amazing to watch the community grow. We've been on the community for about a little less than a year. And I think like when we joined, it was about 500. And now you can see it like grow to 3,000 or maybe even more. It's really hard to keep track.
Yeah.
It's one of the only like engaged communities on like MLOps. And it's so insightful to be part of these conversations, right? To drive all these learnings, given it's still a wild, wild west within MLOps. And it's like kind of communities like these are where standards get kind of defined, workflows get kind of defined. People help each other to make their lives easier in this wild, wild west. So like, we are really happy that you and the team have actually picked up this kind of tough job on maintaining this kind of community. It's a lot of work, and we're happy to actually play a small part of it.
That's awesome. Yeah, for us, it's a labor of love. I think we know that. We all know that. And it is very cool to see these best practices and all of this, like you're talking about, it's the wild, wild west. All of this is emerging as we speak. Each day, new things are coming up in the community and in the greater MLOps space. And even like so much more traction is, it was where you would have to like, I think a year ago, you would have to really search and know who to follow on LinkedIn or on Substack to get any information about MLOps. But now that's completely different. I think every single person in my newsfeed on LinkedIn is talking about how, what is MLOps or MLOps this or MLOps that. So it's definitely gaining some traction, but that might also be because I'm in an echo chamber on my LinkedIn and I just follow people who talk about MLOps and all that good stuff. All right. So
There's actually definitely a lot of activity on MLOps. Of course, like Google just released their managed MLOps like full stack platform just last week. I mean, there's like a ton of activity happening. The market is actually seeing the demand and they are following up like with like a lot of supply. So very exciting space right now.
Yep. Yeah, it is very true. I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening with MLOps. So let's jump into what we came to talk about today. I would love to hear a little bit of background about you before we get into the EU regulation and the monitoring for ML. And maybe it would be a great start just to know like how you came to be where you're at. You're the chief product officer at Fiddler, if I'm not mistaken. What was the journey
that's great.
To that position yeah. like?
Yeah. So prior to Fiddler, I was working at Samsung. I was leading the product team on shopping apps. And so we were using machine learning models for product recommendations. And so if you went to a Samsung like mobile app and you looked at the list of products, that those were recommended by a machine learning model. And I was observing a lot of challenges that the data team was facing just operationalizing these models, right? So just starting off with managing versions of these models, things that we take for granted on Git was like very hard for them. Doing an A-B test on these models was incredibly hard. The way the team would do an A-B test is they would run a previous model for a week, and then they would stop running the model. They would run a new model for the next week. And then they would actually compare at the end of the second week what was the last week's with this new model for the next week. That's like an awful way to run it. And also, I had to make decisions based on the output of these models. And so, like, one of the things I was tasked to do is I was testing the hypothesis that, you know, Samsung users would be open to buying a Samsung product via a chatbot. So if you speak to a Samsung chatbot using Facebook Messenger, you'd go through like this conversation script and then you'd buy it. I was testing that hypothesis. To actually test the hypothesis, we ran an ad campaign, $1 million ad campaign. The target of this ad campaign, 300,000 users, was culled from 21 million users in the database. That came from a machine learning model. And of course, as a product manager, you want to understand why those 300,000 from like the 21 million. And the answer was always, we don't know. The model chose it. It was a propensity model. And so the pilot was not successful in conversion. And till this day, it's not clear to me whether was that the wrong audience like that we went after, or was it something else? So the lack of transparency in the decisioning of these models played a key role, and it came up again and again. And so I connected with Kenneth Krishna, who's the founder CEO, who I'd gone to grad school with and overlapped at kind of Microsoft. And he was facing a similar issue at Facebook. And he was working on a newsfeed, and he joined after US elections. And there was a lot of angst about potential bias in the newsfeed. And it's very hard to dispute that, given it's really a complex ensemble. And so he worked on trying to help internal teams learn why you're seeing a newsfeed story using explainability, and that was also launched externally. So we really aligned on this mission of helping teams build trust with AI, and that's still the mission of the team. That's what brings the team together. That's what brings the investor like kind of together, and it really keeps us going. So that led to the genesis of the company. And it's been great and almost validating to see how our worldview has closer to 2.5 years back when we started is becoming more mainstream. The trust in AI is kind of becoming not just a nice to have, but it's becoming a must have. And especially in the context and in light of this new EU regulation, where Margaret really Vestager comes out and says that the trust is a must have. That really is one of the things that we kind of started out with. And it's very satisfying to see that future worldview actually become present.
That's a and good so at segue kind of Fiddler, into... Oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add at kind of Fiddler, I look at just ensuring that our products stay true to the mission, right? Of not just giving you visibility in the model behavior at like train time, but also post kind of deployment, and kind of weaving that into an experience that's very unique to MLOps, given machine learning models are unique probabilistic entities that need constant new iterations, given their actual performance can actually decay constantly.
So let's jump into the EU regulation, because I know. It's something that I have been talking about quite a bit with my other podcast that I do on AI ethics. I've talked to some of the people that have implemented these different regulations or proposed regulation, I should say. There's a lot of people that are very quick to correct me that it has not been enacted yet, and it is at the very infancy still. So there's lots that can change, and we're looking at something that is probably realistically 3 years out, potentially longer, potentially a little shorter, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. That being said, you probably shouldn't wait 3 years before you start getting all of your shit together, right? It's a lot that is being proposed. And what I've heard from different sources that are very close to this, that are in Brussels, is that it should be looked at, the proposed EU regulation on this should be looked at as like a trifecta with the, there's other regulation that's being proposed around the data and around, now I'm not going to remember the acronyms. Oh, I'm so bad with the acronyms, especially when they make things like GDPR and all that. But there's like, I can't remember the acronyms, but I'll figure it out and put it in the show notes later. The three different proposed regulation that they have, there's one on AI specifically, there's one on data, and then there's one on the sharing of the data and all of that good stuff. And I'll figure that out. I'll come back to it in a minute. But we should probably mention what we were talking about before we hit record, which was this idea of what is the new regulation, the high risk, the three different sectors that they've put together, or the three different types of AI that they've put together, and what that means for different companies. Anybody that is working in machine learning right now, what does that mean for us?
Yeah, great point. It's a pretty, I just kind of wanted to start off, you know, by saying like kind of something we were discussing. It's a pretty detailed proposed regulation. It's around 80 pages, and I am surprised how much time the team spent on kind of crafting this. It's pretty well written. The goal that the EU seems to be going for with this proposed regulation is they really want to go after helping like teams build human-centric and trustworthy AI. That's the goal of this regulation, and that's kind of precisely the point that the EU commissioner made, that trust is a must. And as she came out with this proposed regulation, and while it is proposed, typically proposed regulations get voted on, and then it does take a couple of years for it to go into effect. And there might be some changes that'll happen from now till the one that gets voted on and accepted. And there'll be a couple of years before it really goes into effect, just like GDPR did. But to summarize what the proposed regulation is doing, with trust at its core, it first classifies AIs into four kind of categories, right? It says first category is really unacceptable risk applications that are banned, right? And these are applications like behavior manipulation, for example. They're banned, right? The second one, and now we're getting into the less stringent ones. The second one is high-risk applications. And these high-risk applications are, let's say, for example, self-driving cars, right? Or let's say credit scoring. They will have new oversight. So, and we'll kind of talk about what this oversight is. The third one is limited risk applications. And these are the likes of let's say, chatbots. And there are some transparency requirements for these limited risks. For example, if it says if you're talking to a chatbot, you should know that you're talking to AI, right? It's really simple, right? Like kind of guidelines. And the last one is minimal risk application. And this, they believe, will be the majority of like AI applications. And there's no proposed intervention here. And here an example of this is a spam filter, right? A limited, minimal risk application that can continue as is. And let's deep dive into high risk applications, because that's where the first thing that a team who wants to view whether this kind of regulation applies to them is whether they fall in this high risk application. And so high risk applications are really ones that have implications on let's say public safety, services, their actual opportunities, right? And examples of these are, let's say, credit scoring, right? Loans. Examples of these are recruitment. We spoke about, let's say, self-driving cars or, like, let's say, robotic surgery, right? So these are high-risk applications. So the first thing is, do you fall in this high-risk application? And the next thing is, what does high-risk application, like, what are these new actual guidelines? And so what the proposed regulation stipulates is that there are requirements around high-quality data sets, right? You've got to make sure that you're using high-quality data. The system is documented well, and there's record keeping, right? So you know, in case things go wrong, you can go back to it, right? There are requirements on transparency, knowing how this model was built, how it operates, and included in this transparency is fairness and bias implications on certain protected attributes like race and so on, and human oversight. So it uses human oversight a little bit differently from transparency, right? The ability for a human to come in and control this. Of course, a human needs kind of transparency, but they need the ability to actually control it. And finally, it says that once you know how this model is working, it's transparent, high quality data, you need to have operational visibility into this model to ensure it's working at the actual accuracy that you trained it with, to ensure it's still robust, it's not failing. Like for example, if you had something like a self-driving car that was trained like well, but it ran into like live data that completely makes it a hazard, right? That should not happen. You should be able to monitor it. And finally, yeah, so there's robustness aspects, accuracy aspects, and security aspects to get this operational visibility. So that's the high level of what the proposed regulation means, and we can deep dive into what does it mean in the context of transparency, what does it mean in the context of like operational visibility.
Yeah, I think there's something to note that we were talking about before about the idea or how they specifically called out that AI in the military is not falling under any of this. And that is a bit of a shame, because it's like saying, yeah, okay, we're going to set this bar very, very high for everything, but we can kill people with AI and that's not a problem at all. And you're like, wait a minute, the hypocrisy here is ridiculous. So hopefully in some of these new iterations, it will come into effect. But just as a side note, I went and I Googled what the damn names of these other acts are that I couldn't remember. And there's the Digital Services Act and there's the Digital Marketing Act, the DSA and the DMA. And they should be looked at as like the trifecta of all of these together really are trying to help Europe as a society go forward in a way that they feel is, like you said, it's ensuring trust between society and technology. And so I find that fascinating. Now, yeah, let's maybe we can deep dive into some of that you were saying at the end there, or you have something you want to talk about on as far as the military goes and why they chose not to single out the military?
It's a good point. My sense is there's a little bit of an unknown there that they probably have not really like run into a lot of military applications. So they don't know what they don't know. And they probably wanted to keep that door open. But it feels like there would be potential pushback on that. And there might be language in like other iterations of this regulation that might bring in certain trust aspects there. At least whatever they do, they ensure that like some of these kind of guidelines of high risk applications are also applicable there. That's what I feel. But it feels like it's more they wanted to have that option, not knowing how they're going to deploy it, to just make sure that it doesn't hold them back in situations of like emergencies.
Yeah, that makes sense too. And one person I interviewed before said it's very hard to get regulation passed on current dangerous weapons. You know, like something like chemical weapons or landmines, and getting those banned or getting treaties signed around those, which we know what the effects are. It's even harder to get things passed when it is some made up thing that could potentially happen in the future. So I understand that reasoning too. I hope that it's changed, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. So what's been
really interesting is in the US, so the DoD, that, you know, so they've actually come out with more focus on trust in AI. So there has been like a team formed called JAIC, J-A-I-C. And that team is now looking at how do you bring in like transparency and trustworthiness to like AI. And so the US has kind of like absorbed the implications of black box AI, and especially in the context of DoD. So I think the DoD had like a principal document that they kind of like released, and now they recently got kind of allocated budget through like a defense pool that was approved, I think, towards the start of this year. So it's kind of interesting to see that in the US, DoD is actually focusing on increasing trust within AI.
It's good to hear you mention defense, because I think that's been one of the more interesting areas, you know, particularly what the Department of Defense has been doing with AI position papers. It's, as you said, the joint center that they put together. I think both of the last few defense secretaries have had a pretty, you know, aggressive focus, you could say, on how AI has been, you know, important on the battlefield and its implications for the country and, you know, a strategic competition with China. So I think that's certainly an area to watch, especially because we know so much of the technology pipeline in the US particularly tends to come from defense and national security with the space race and post-Cold War, and, you know, so much happened in the 90s with the internet. So I think it's certainly an area to watch. One of the questions I have around this idea of regulation in AI coming out of Europe, but also just more broadly, there are a lot of different areas and sectors, obviously, where AI can have vastly different impacts. In advertising and commerce, it's playing perhaps a more direct and hands-on role in terms of how it's impacting customers and real people. But when we look at areas like healthcare or even energy or other more advisory scenarios, it's working more with trained professionals, people who may have that ability to control AI, as you mentioned, the European Union wants to see as part of its regulation. What's your perspective, you know, as an MLOps company and an explainable AI company, on the diversity of industries where AI is having an impact, and how do you see explainability varying across those different sectors?
That's a good question. While the need of explainability is broad, and we get to hear a whole lot of that from prospective customers across a variety of like verticals, the urgent need for explainability comes from verticals that are facing the problem today on the ground and cannot run their business. And so these typically tend to be businesses that want to or are using AI, but they need to make sure that they're meeting some guidelines, some regulations. For example, within kind of banking in the US, there's a stipulation of like SR 117 that the Fed laid out, at the end of the last crash in 2008. And that means that you need to have visibility into how your model has been trained, how it's behaving, and then you need to have visibility into ensuring that it's working well after deployment so that you don't take down the financial system again. It was meant for quantitative models, but it is also applicable to AI models. So the need for explainability on the ground, the ones who have the budget and are buying are where they want to use AI and are hitting into regulations that mandate transparency today, right? And so I think that's one part. Now there are also companies who want to be good corporate citizens and are also seeing the potential pitfalls of not being transparent. For example, there have been recent issues of kind of potential bias in models. There have been social media companies which were recently in like news. Of course, there was a famous facial recognition case where facial recognition really software was not recognizing people well if they've got darker skin tones. And because of that problem, a lot of companies exited the facial recognition market. The groundswell of protest by people, right? So the second need is coming from these group of companies who want to be good kind of corporate citizens, or want to ensure that they don't have any PR issues with the AI that they're deploying. And so the asset diversity there is pretty broad, depending on how widely used their actual AI is and what kind of potential brand impacts that that they might have. Beyond that, teams are looking at explainability to really bolster their development and kind of ensure that they are building AI models, building the best AI models, and not just for transparency.
Trying to, it's a combination of trying to deal with existing regulations where for your current products, you need to make sure that there is acceptance amongst regulators, acceptance amongst customers, but there's also a sort of bent towards customers that want to use it to develop new products and how it informs new product development. So regular product development and new product development. That makes sense. And I think it really jives with how I have seen this play out in healthcare. And as our listeners know, I work at a medical device company, and in the healthcare industry, we've had this regulations around software as a medical device, around, the FDA's good machine learning practices, which have recently been rolled out and kind of are similar to what the FDA has been offering in other realms, like good manufacturing or good clinical practice, in the lab diagnostics and in the sort of biotech spaces. And so I think there the lesson kind of has been, the FDA has had to bridge the gap between how does machine learning impact today and how does machine learning impact tomorrow, and what does product development tomorrow versus today look like. And as a product manager, I think it probably must be very interesting to you how companies are responding to this in terms of just their management structure and the kind of talent that they're retaining.
It's very interesting now as teams go beyond just looking at explainability, right? Beyond the actual regulated use cases, right? Lending, healthcare, recruitment. There are other use cases which are high value, right? Like in oil and natural gas, if you're going to drill something, if you're going to drill a site, it's about $10, $20 million. And it's typically AI that's making a decision where to drill. And not knowing why AI made a decision is, could cost you $10 to $20 million, right? So explainability there is more like a need to ensure that you're making decisions with the right ROI. But what we're also seeing is like teams are now coupling explainability with monitoring, right? So it's not enough to know how the models are behaving, but also ensuring that you know how they're behaving when they're running, operational aspects of it, not just pre-deployment, but also post-deployment, right? So that you, because given the nature of machine learning models, which are really probabilistic, they can decay over time. The data that they see might be different. than the data that they've been trained on. And so explainability in that context is also incredibly important, and that ties into monitoring, which also ties into this broader MPM or model performance management kind of domain.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect segue into the next question that I wanted to ask about MPM, or what you've dubbed as model performance monitoring, a bit of a playoff of application performance monitoring, I think. And the first thing that jumps out at me when I read the blog post that Krishna wrote, which we can link below for anybody that's interested, is how is this different, or how is this the same as what some have been going around talking about when it comes to the evaluation store? And I think it's like Josh Tobin, who's the full stack deep learning guy, he has been talking about this need for monitoring each process or each way, each piece of the puzzle, each step along the way. You need to be monitoring everything and making sure that it has good enough metrics to get the check so that it can move to the next step. And when I read this blog post, it felt like that's what you were calling for too. So how do these two differ, and is it the same?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think different, you know, companies in this domain are talking to their customers, and they're kind of converging on the same problem that they're seeing, right? So, you know, so I think different, you know, companies are actually coming up with similar solutions. So I think they are mostly similar. So the premise of MPM, really, like, for folks who are hearing about this the first time, is like, model development is a very iterative process. You don't just create one model and you deploy it, like, kind of software and kind of get done with it. It's very iterative. And this iterative process of model operationalization, within this, you have to focus on understanding and improving model performance. And you do that through visibility across all the parts of the model lifecycle. So really, that is MPM. How do you improve understanding and model performance through visibility across the lifecycle? And what does it mean in really different parts of the lifecycle? It might mean at train time, you know, when you have training sets that you're using for your model, you can assess them for bias. You can assess them for any data quality issues. You can also get feedback from your current model champion running in production on actual data, feed that back into the data, and create a new high quality data set with actual representation of live data. At validation, this could mean that you focus on how your model is behaving on certain slices of the data, right? So this could mean like slices of low performance, or if you're like a lending model, slices where you're making loans to men versus women, or loans in one state to another, right? It could be slices that are of, like, let's say, business interest, or it could be slices that are of kind of, have kind of performance implications. At deployment time, this could mean that you're recording traffic that your model is about to serve, and you're about to do a champion challenger, or maybe one kind of champion and multiple challenger kind of tests. At monitoring, of course, and this is where a lot of focus seems to be, but it's one part of like MPM, you're assessing this traffic that you're recording for drift, for like data integrity issues, if it's having outliers. And finally, there's an analysis part where when your model is facing issues, you now have to root cause it within live. And so trying to analyze that, maybe in the context of the slices that you just validated the model against at the train time, right? You can use the same slices. And then that gives you a new worldview that feeds back into the training set. So this iterative process where you're constantly, where a model is constantly converging, diverging on kind of its actual performance because data is changing. The management of this across multiple versions of your models, that is MPM. And you could also view this in the context of, if you want to store everything in one location, it could be an evaluation store. We believe it's like a meta layer that sits on top of your actual MLOps that hooks into all the paths of your MLOps lifecycle and gives you visibility into how your model performance is doing in the context of the model, the entire model, or slices of the model. So you can be better equipped to like ensure that your model is operating at peak performance.
So this notion of model performance management and the associated idea of control theory sounds a lot like very inspired by other engineering disciplines and how, you know, they may approach certain dynamic or probabilistic systems. Could you talk a little bit about how other engineering fields have influenced your approach to thinking about machine learning, or, you know, whether that's an accurate assumption on my end, and maybe even what control theory kind of is related, how that relates to model performance management?
Yeah, well, kind of control theory really, like, for example, if you're driving a car, control theory says, well, one aspect is you're just measuring the speed of the car, right? But control theory really means that you not just measure it, but you can influence it. So you can actually keep it at, you've got sensors that not just tell you what it's doing, but you can control the speed based on the input. So if your desired speed is, let's say, 25 miles an hour, the sensor tells you 27, now you can control the sensor and say, come down to 25, right? So in case of models, that means that, let's say, for example, you're not really going for highest accuracy in your model, but you're trying to ensure that the model has a certain acceptable level of bias across predicted attributes. And so when you train it and it's at that acceptable level of bias, and when you deploy it, as the data shifts in real time, that bias, like a threshold, might be breached. So that's where control theory comes in. Like, you first having visibility that is being breached, and feeding whatever that new data representation is back into your training set, so you can create a new representation of that model that meets that new threshold, the new reality that you're seeing within production. So it is an extension of kind of control theory, given that you first have to have visibility into how a thing behaves. Like, a whole lot of teams don't even know how their models are behaving when they deploy, right? So that's like number one, not having any operational insights. And once you have operational insights, how do you ensure that it's maintaining your desired metrics, right? And that is where the control theory comes in.
Yeah, that's a really interesting sort of explanation of how different systems work and how they should work, you know, how they should be able to be controlled. And I think this is one of the questions that I think a lot of times I know I spend time on, and other software engineers, other machine learning engineers in our community talk about, which is, how do you actually turn an abstraction into something that's usable, right? Or the idea for an abstraction into something that's usable. For example, you know, the idea of a pipeline. That's a commonly used design pattern or abstraction that we talk a lot about in the community. Google Cloud has written about it, and Pachyderm has some really nice sort of features that talk about how to do a build pipeline. And that's how that idea of what should, you know, what a model development pipeline should look like is translated into like a particular sort of software's or cloud provider's tooling. In your case, could you talk a little bit more about how this abstraction around control theory and model performance management, how does that actually look like for a machine learning engineer like me? What kind of code, how does this change the code that I'm writing?
The way to think about it is that, like, let's look at what goes on today, right? Today, teams typically have some data. They train a model. Either it could be handcrafted, it could be using AutoML, and it's likely tuned for highest accuracy. And then you just take this model. If it's through AutoML, you don't really know what kind of relationships it dropped. You then go and deploy it, and then you don't monitor it because you assume that the reality that your model faces meets the hypothetical training set. So this is what teams do today. In the MPM world, what you would do is when you get that data, you would first analyze the data to make sure that the data is meeting your quality needs, right? In this case, is like, let's say you were trying to assess for bias, right? How's the label distribution happening across protected attributes? Like, should you have more samples of one versus the other based on the fairness metric that you're trying to assess? How many instances of, like, what is the distribution of the data? Does it have a whole lot of missing values where you want it to grab relationships without the missing values and so on? And so then you go on to the post-model training phase, where when your model is trained, how do you learn the what relationships the model is grabbing? Today, that's kind of typically not what like a data scientist does. You might do some ad hoc testing on a few instances and see, you know, let's say you were doing a lending model, right? You would be like, hey, this loan should have been rejected, right? You just run it through like a validation test, through like a validation data set or through a test data set. But you don't really like look at what are the important features of this model? What are the lowest performing regions of this model? How is this model behaving in the context of certain protected classes or maybe certain slices that might be relevant to data? For example, loans made to certain states, right? So that is not typically done today, and that's one of the aspects of like MPM. So teams would be logging this model in the context of the data and running the analysis to ensure they know how the model is behaving, right? You might not just be doing global feature importances. You might be doing ice plots. You might be doing PDPs, right? Not just at the global level, but at like a region level. And in the monitoring like part, you would then be looking at not just in the context of the data that the model is facing in live. You would look at it in the context of slices that you just validated the model against. If, for example, you have set a threshold for bias, or if for example, loans made in California are really important, you would look at it from the lens of that. So you would need tooling not just to help you monitor broadly, but also at a very specific level. If you have bias thresholds, if you have certain slices that you want to monitor, certain metrics, right? It might be that you could have trained the model for like accuracy. You want to ensure that you know that you're meeting the accuracy. At times, you might not even have ground truths like labels coming in real time. So you might not have accuracy metrics, in which case you'll have to use, let's say, Datadrift to be able to give you a leading indicator, right? And then once you're seeing something drift, or let's say data integrity issues like really happening, then you use that representation of data that your model is facing in live and feed that back into your training set. So you can train a model that accurately represents the reality versus the hypothetical. So none of these things are done by a typical data scientist today, and that's what they would need to do within an MPM flow.
Got it. All an incredible set of very helpful activities, things that we would like to do that it's hard to do.
Correct.
And I think that's kind of your point right now. It's sufficiently hard today, and as a result, people don't have the investment and the time that they need on these things to do those things.
Correct.
And I know you mentioned data scientist, and I just want to be clear. Is the idea in the sort of fiddler view of the world that the data scientists are doing this, not necessarily a machine learning engineer or a software engineer focused on machine learning, but it's more actually the model development experts themselves?
So it's a mix of data scientists and machine learning engineers. In fact, what we're also seeing in some teams, the traditional DevOps folks who monitored web apps are being repurposed to monitor machine learning apps, right? And so that's also happening. But our typical users are data scientists who want to know more about this model that they've trained, ensuring that it's not biased, ensuring that they know if there are regions of lower performance, if there are regions of interest within the model pre-deployment. And then post-deployment, we've seen some teams, some kind of companies where it's really data scientists that actually stay on top of the models once they are deployed, or it can be machine learning engineers as well. This is where I think the job functions are still being formalized across data science and this world of MLOps, especially within MLOps. There's like we've not seen a whole lot of purpose-built MLOps teams that handle these deployments. They're being like repurposed from let's say DevOps. We've seen ML engineers also kind of do the deployment, but maybe not stay on top of the operational model. Maybe it's actually data scientists. So it's still being carved out. It's not as well defined as like the traditional DevOps separation of tasks.
So it's one thing that reminds me of what you're saying, and even this question that you had, Vishnu, was last week when I was talking to Chris Berg. He was saying one of the quotes that I took away from that conversation was when he said, you as someone who is working on a data product, you own the result. You don't own your piece. And I found that to be fascinating because it's, you have to make sure that whoever you're working with, whatever they're doing is also making the result be better. And it's not that, okay, I built my model and I'm good and now it's your problem, or I did this and now whatever, you figure it out, right? There's no more throwing it over the fence, which we talk about a lot, but it's much easier said than done. And that's why I think we talk about it so much. And so it's really interesting what you're talking about, Amit, on how there's these different roles and there's all of this that hasn't really decided who is going to be the owner of this, but there are people that are interested and there are people that want to ensure that it's happening.
Yeah. We've got secondary users beyond just data scientists and like the actual MLEs. These are folks who are decision makers running the business who want to know how the ML is working. Then there are folks within ops who are taking calls from like customers on why they're seeing the output a certain way from an ML model. We are also seeing folks who are secondary stakeholders within machine learning that want to know more and build trust with these models that impact them. So while there are primary users, there's a whole host of secondary users. And we've built the product to be able to be consumed easily by these range of users who might not be technical as like the primary users.
I think that's so crucial. I know that, you know, a lot of times on the community, we have these intense technical discussions. Which AWS tool to use? Is GCP doing this? Should Vertex, you know, is Vertex a product that I should adopt? But the really hard question is, what are we doing here? And who's doing what based on the talent we have? I think that's why so much of what Demetrius and I talk about with people like you, experts in the field, ends up becoming who are we enabling? Who's taking on different responsibilities with respect to the success of ML? Because, you know, we can talk until the end of time about the relative merits of, you know, different tools and different development processes. But if you don't really have a clear target, or if you don't really have a good idea of what success looks like for AI in the context of your business, what success looks like for machine learning and how different people fit into that, it doesn't really matter what tools you use. I mean, it really doesn't. And I think, you know, today, you know, the company that I work at, you know, that's the clarity that we're pushing towards. And it really, trust me, it really has not been driven by the fact that I have adopted one, sort of experiment management tool versus another, yeah. Right? I think one of the questions I have, because it's clear to me that you're talking to a wide scope of industries, not just, you know, the kind of maybe, you know, I'm in my healthcare bubble. I think, you know, Demetrius talks to a lot of different ethics professionals, and in our community, we have a lot of consultancies, ops companies themselves, and also some consumer tech companies. What would you say is one industry where the movement around explainability, you were surprised by how robust it was? I guess I'm just looking for your favorite surprise. Yeah.
Surprise. Well, I think banking is still one where you would like what you would expect is, hey, there's regulation and there's a little bit of an unknown. So that really causes teams to take a step back and, you know, maybe become a lot more conservative about the new technology, right? So you would expect banks not wanting to do AI because it's like a little bit of like a gray area in how to kind of like deploy these, how to get it really validated and through like regulators. However, I was surprised that they all wanted to push the boundaries of what AI models can do. And we've seen, as we work with banks, we've seen complex models, like not just your typical ML models, like an XGBoost or Logistic. We've seen deep learning models with complex data types, right? So the surprise was how much they want to adopt AI and how much they want to push that boundary and kind of ensure that they're still abiding by the regulations and not just staying on the sidelines and saying, we'll kind of let it play out. And then when kind of somebody comes in and has a solution that's kind of like ratified and works at scale, that's when we'll adopt. That was a surprise, at least from banking, which has historically been very very conservative, right? It's high regulations, but in the domain of AI, they are forming teams. For example, they are forming AI like teams for AI, like doing AI this kind of governance, where the teams are formulated only to validate machine learning models. So they try to crack machine learning models using tools like ours and kind of validate that. And so they are rapidly forming these new teams. They're doing a lot of investments.
Very interesting. Got it. Yeah, it's actually very interesting to hear you say that because I certainly had that preconceived notion. You know, so many pop culture descriptions of banking and finance kind of say, you know, the traders want to do something and then compliance or risk management says no.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to hear that there's so much emphasis on AI, on pushing the boundaries.
A second surprise, I think, on the opposite direction, right, is I would have thought insurance would have taken up a lot of AI ML, but we are not seeing as much adoption as you would have expected. It's lightly regulated, right, not as much as banking. So you would have seen a lot more adoption through premium pricing and whatnot. And from what we've learned is it's due to a lack of data. And not sure if this is applicable to all the insurance companies, but that's a surprise in the opposite way where, oh, I would have expected a lot more adoption here, but it's not. And in banking, it's like, oh, there's a lot of adoption where I thought they'd be more like conservative.
Look at that. I got a bonus. So banking is ahead and insurance is not where we thought it would be. And I think, it is. That's interesting because I think, you know, if I had to speculate, you know, insurance is a little bit diversified regionally and geographically. You tend to find a lot of, you know, at least in health insurance, right? You have regional providers in different markets, even in auto and life and different markets. You know, you'll have places that have their own sort of geographic focus. Whereas I think in banking and finance, I mean, with what we've seen, I guess through the 80s and 90s, it has been this movement towards big national and multinational companies that maybe are pioneering this investment more. So that's interesting. I always like to ask that because it's, you know, you know, these different industries, they impact one another in terms of how they go about things. In terms of, you know, another question I kind of had in a slightly different direction. If you were, you know, advising a machine learning engineer or a data scientist in terms of how they should go about pushing the agenda for explainable AI or model performance management in their company, let's say, you know, somebody is listening to this podcast, what advice would you give to them in terms of how to get started and how to get their company and their, maybe their engineering group, maybe the executive buy-in? How would you advise them to kind of that change model in the same way that DevOps kind of has changed models? What advice would you give to that professional?
So different functions have different incentives that move them towards this goal. For like machine learning models, of course, the like teams that deploy machine learning models on use cases, given the investment that you need to make in, you know, building machine learning teams and tooling, the use cases that they deploy to first are the highest value use cases, right? You don't want to deploy it on like a low value use cases after making all these investments. So for the thing that resonates with a business user is, hey, you know, you've made all these investments in machine learning and you built this model. Do you want to make sure that your business metrics are still like working well and that you stay on top of it in real time? You know that, you know, if your model has operational issues, you can jump on top of it and address it. Or if you're in a lightly regulated or like a highly regulated domain, you have visibility into how your model works. So you actually protect it against not just fines, but also PR risks, right? So that resonates with a business, you know, quote unquote buyer or a user. On the ground, within DevOps, within the actual management part of these models, you can call it old school DevOps or new school MLOps teams that are still forming. The things they care about is how do they stay on top of these models? What we're seeing is like teams that now have 5 models are expecting next year to have 10 to 15 to 50, right? And so they've seen the pain of managing just 5. So how do you can't babysit these models. You have better things to do. So how do you manage this massive scale of AI models that is coming your way if you have 5 models? So save your time, right? You don't want to spend your time really babysitting these models. And that resonates to that audience that's managing these deployed models, whether it's like an MLE in newer teams or whether it's old school DevOps. And for data scientists, the thing that resonates is more helping business teams understand how their models that they're working are behaving, right? Whether, of course, if you're in a bank, you're mandated that these validation teams that are built up, which are in the second line of defense that are validating these models, that they can crack the model and explain it to a regulator or like a compliance. But beyond that, if you're not in a regulated kind of domain, knowing how your model works can help you unlock potential, like kind of performance benefits, can help you debug the model. Models are incredibly hard to debug. You're just training a model for high accuracy, but you don't know how that accuracy is actually distributed. So the thing that resonates with a data scientist is helping others understand how the model is doing, helping them understand it so they can debug it or they can improve the performance. Those are the three kind of groups and the three incentives that resonate. So for a data scientist who's looking to get this adopted, those are the three things that I would hit. I would go to like the team that's managing these models and say, hey, you know, you've managed the 5 models that I trained, and now you're like managing, you know, you've got operational insights. Do you have tools to help you ensure that you stay on top of when these models go bad or go awry? And then going and talking to the actual business owner and ensuring that they have the right tools to ensure that their performance of these models in high ROI cases are still being maintained. and they have the right tooling, because typically the actual budgets might come from somewhere else, but the user might be somebody else.
So
right.
Bringing this all back full circle, and where we started the conversation with the EU regulation and now finishing it with the MPM, how do you see these two linking up or wedding together?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, so the EU for high risk, it says you need to ensure that your model is sufficiently transparent to enable users to understand and control how these models work, right? And the degree of transparency depends on whether it's internal users, external users, right? So you need to, so within MPM, in the step of like training validation, right? When you're trying to understand more about the model using explainability, using model analytics, you know, that we have, that meets the spirit of the new regulation well. And then the second part of the regulation that says, hey, you know, you've got to ensure that when there is any deviation from the accuracy or robustness of the model, the teams have the ability to kind of jump in and ensure that they can intervene right away. So this is the monitoring aspect of like MPM. So ensuring that you have monitoring for these deployed models on your metrics, to make sure that, let's say, if you're tracking for accuracy, if you have live ground truth, if that accuracy dips for, let's say, a self-driving car, you know right away if this is a high-risk model that's happening, so you can jump and you can fix the model. And there are also aspects of record keeping and fairness, right? So like within kind of validation, not just knowing how your model works, but how does it work in the context of kind of protected classes, which is also part of the regulation. So within MPM, being able to validate that in the context of fairness metrics, which might be domain specific, is one part that also feeds into the regulation. And for record keeping, the fact that you've logged all your training sets, you've logged your model predictions, right, serves as record for your high risk application. So you can go back and you can review it, you can replay it, and then you can use that for creating higher quality data sets, which is also one of the requirements of the high risk AI applications. The second thing I think so on top of the high risk application requirements, the law also encourages that teams that have limited risk applications or minimal risk applications, that they also abide by the same guidelines, because you might be a business that has, let's say, one high risk application, but you might have many low risk or minimal risk like applications. Why would you only deploy these kind of guidelines, tools, and processes on just the high risk? Why not just do it across all? So then you have good visibility and you've got a streamlined like process. So you can use MPM not just for the high risk as mandated by the regulation, but also you can deploy it for low and limited risk, so that you get the benefits of having a model like run at peak kind of performance, and the actual benefits of really transparency for those models as well across your organization.
All right. Well, this was a deep dive. I will say that. Hopefully everyone has stayed with us and is happy to have gotten schooled on this. I really appreciate the way that you all at Fiddler are trying to push the envelope as far as monitoring and making sure that it is just a more robust and complete process. So thanks again, Amit, for coming on here, talking to us about everything under the sun when it comes to monitoring and also some new EU regulation. This has been fascinating. Everyone that is interested in checking out Fiddler, you can find a link to their stuff below. I encourage you to just at least get a demo from them and say hi to Amit if he's there giving you the demo. Let him know that you heard him talking about all this and you appreciate it. That's all we got for today. I think, and Vishnu, unless you got any other final thoughts, we're going to log off.
Yeah, just just want to say, I think this was very helpful from a practitioner standpoint to dive into this model performance management and control theory and the different elements of regulations. I think a big part of being successful as a practitioner and building systems is communicating what you're doing and what you need to do. And so I think, thank you, Amit, for coming on and sharing your perspectives from that standpoint and helping me be better at my job.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think it's pretty fascinating how this whole space is evolving. Of course, we didn't have any proposed regulation 3 weeks back. Now we do. And the whole notion of MPM didn't quite exist close to 6 months back. And now we have versions of it already kind of circulating. So I'm pretty excited to see how the space evolves, not just in like a year, but in the next 6 months, and how this like regulation evolves, and like maybe what the US does in like response. I think the Biden administration might be taking a relook at the Algorithmic Accountability Act that was proposed back in 2019, might be reintroduced, and maybe the US might also have a bill that. They might lead with and not just be laggards as compared to what the EU did with, like, let's say GDPR.
Yeah, that's optimistic. I like it, though. I think it's definitely needed. I wonder if it's going to happen. We'll see, because, yeah, Biden is, I have heard things that he is really gung-ho about this, and his administration wants to do things and lead in certain aspects of this. So we'll see in the next 6 months. By the time we have you back on here, then we're going to have a whole new landscape to talk about, and it'll be just as fun. So thanks again, Amit, and thanks everyone for listening. We will catch you later.
Thank you.
See ya.
Keep up the good work.